Left 4 Dead, a zombie-infested first-person shooter with a focus on co-op gameplay, entered new territory for Valve in 2008. Rather than relying on meticulous, unchanging level design, its dynamic nature reacts to your movements and skill, creating a more unpredictable experience. That kind of difficulty balancing has been in use since the 80s, and may be most noticeable in the rubber band AI of racing games. But Valve's AI director for Left 4 Dead aimed to give the approach a far wider scope. It didn't just conjure harder enemies for better players, or increase their frequency as required. There was more to it than ammo drops, and health whenever things got too much. Instead, the approach is holistic, incorporating narrative elements, visual effects, and impressively, music. Though Valve are a very collaborative company, who often handle problems as a group and share roles, Left 4 Dead's music was mostly put together by Mike Moraski. Having already worked on Team Fortress 2 and Portal for the company, not to mention a wider career stretching back nearly three decades, Mike came to the task with a wealth of experience. That's why his previous appearance in this series, covering Portal and Portal 2, features nearly 2 hours of insight. Amazingly, after that detailed conversation, Mike still had time to discuss Left 4 Dead and its innovative music director. Just like the gameplay itself, Left 4 Dead's soundtrack is never set in stone, scoring your actions with a flexible system that also gives information the player needs to survive. I'm Lee Tyrrell, and this is The Sound Test, where I look in depth into video game audio and music, along with the very people who crafted it. Joining Mike Moraski, you'll also hear some background from Ellen McLean, who provided voice acting to Left 4 Dead, and Jonathan Colton, whose songs can be heard in its sequel through a number of jukeboxes. I also discussed Left 4 Dead 2 with Mike, but it was the original game that built the scaffolding from scratch. In its early development, what were Mike's first thoughts for the music's atmosphere, which tips its hat to the historic tone of horror B-movies?
Left 4 Dead was pretty organically, I was immediately looking for what's the big concepts, what's the architecture that I can kind of come up with to, you know, make some coherence. And I, musically speaking, I came up with some ideas straight away that I thought were pretty cool. I called them hybrid scales. I know scale, I just can't memorize the 40 billion scales that exist in the world. And I know that there's some kind of octatonic scale that is represented by what I came up with. But the way I came up with it was sort of this, you know, Phrygian meets major kind of smashed together scale system, which is mostly is just chromatics with a couple full steps in there. The very first piece we did was the main theme, or at least a rough version of it, right? Which is where that scale comes from. And it tells a little story. That scale is built from a story, right? Which tells the story of technology gone awry, people get sick, and that's sad. But then maybe there's hope, and then no, actually they're sick, and they're super dangerous, and then everything goes to hell.
That scale, and the sound it creates, is used throughout the game's music as a whole. Like film motifs, which Mike would further evoke for Portal 2, it stitches the experience together. As you encounter special infected like the tank, who essentially act as mini-bosses, dedicated themes surround them and warn you of their presence. They follow the same scale as the main theme, or more accurately, parts of it, in order to fit comfortably into the audio's overall palette.
Almost the entire score is built from that scale, including the tank theme. So we put the tank theme in the game, and it happens such that the tank theme starts when the tank is spawned, and the tank is almost, I mean, by not all, almost, it's always spawned out of sight, as pretty much anything that spawns should be, so you don't want to see a thing spawn into the world. By consequence, usually the tank is a little ways away, right? And so the tank's a little ways away, the music plays, and everybody's like, I love how that works. That's great. That sounds good. It makes them really scary, etc., etc. Well, then one day there's a bug in the game, and the tank theme doesn't play any longer. As a consequence, people aren't getting this warning that the tank has spawned into the game and is a little ways away. Developers are often like, oh, I don't like music in games. It's sort of this L-E-E-T sort of way of thinking about games sometimes, which is music doesn't really have a place in them. Everybody was like, oh my god, put that fucking music back in the game.
Seemingly by accident, the true importance of the tank theme, and eventually those of the other special infected, became clear. It was thanks to the music that players were given the chance to prepare and position themselves. Without it, the game gives no clue that a gigantic, undead fist is about to take you out.
Especially early on, the tank was almost 90% of the time like a reset. Like, you almost every time you would die and have to go back to the beginning because it was so hard. So it was super stressful. And without the music, it was extra stressful. So when we realized, like, God, people really react to that. Like, that is powerful. People really want it in the game. So we started solving a lot of problems that we came upon. Like, how are we going to let people know X or Y or Z? The first thing we did is we put music to it, which worked for me. Again, it's like this thing of like, oh, okay, I'll make a motif for everything. I'll play it from where the thing is in the world, or at least have some sort of coded mechanism for letting you know.
Sound design has always been important to guiding a player and tracking progress through a level, but applying that so strongly to the actual music meant that Mike had to find a way to make it consistent, but variable enough to produce satisfying effects. To solve these problems, Mike used some interesting techniques and trickery to keep the soundtrack from getting too stale.
You know, let's say, for example, you know, when one of the specials are small bosses, you know, like the smoker. There's little themes that would play from them at kind of these semi-random intervals so that you would know that they're out there and kind of, you know, where they are. But what I ended up doing, instead of playing them quieter and louder, I think they do have a little bit of fall off, as we call it, like quieter and louder, depending on how far they, what way they are. I'm actually using different instruments, right? So like when they're further away, they play maybe with a trumpet or something. And then when they get closer, it's strings or whatever it happens to be. Again, I don't actually remember the specifics, but there's sort of this coded set of things in there to let you know. I pretty quickly started to realize that there wasn't ever going to be a way for me to create a real classic musical structure that I could obey things like, oh, here's a rhythm track and then tags. And, you know, I'm going to try and quantize things and make it all work together as this beautiful magical whole. I wanted things to really respond like, you know, when they happen. So instead of kind of trying to take that approach, I went literally almost the opposite direction, which was, because everything was built from this sort of scale thing that I came up with, and then a sort of a harmonic structure I'd built around that, I made it so that, at least the idea was that if I made everything so that they could randomly all kind of happen in their own space or at their, like, whenever they needed to, and they would just juxtapose and augment whatever was happening before, regardless of what it was, that it could kind of turn into this self-generating tapestry.
A more traditional soundtrack would have been easier to compose, but less inspiring and memorable. In Left 4 Dead, music is never just slapped on top in an attempt to strengthen a story's emotions. It's as much a part of the living structure of the game, and integral to your success in challenging sections. Mike's work covered new ground in video games, so how did he begin to build such a complex system?
There was a bunch of things I had to learn and figure out in that process. One of which, just from a musical standpoint, instead of that idea of like everything synced and there's tempos and markers and that sort of approach, which is super valid and I've used it in other cases, but I did the opposite. Like everything's it's in that scale, but it's in its own space in the scale. It's got its own like set of notes that it's allowed to use, right? That's different from everybody else's. Everything's in a slightly different tempo, right? So that you never end up, you know, sort of this problem of, it's sort of like the uncanny valley of music or whatever. It's like, if things are too close to working in a normal way, but they don't, you really notice that it's broken. And I cheat a little bit too. There's always just this splash cymbal, like, psh. That doesn't always happen. There's often little things that aren't just like taking over like that. So I kind of built all these pieces so that they're different enough from each other that there's never going to be sort of this thing of like, oh, they almost work, but they don't. You know, it's always like, whoa, it's a different, they're like these unique pieces. So you've got that, but then the system that plays them and decides when to play them and how to play them.
When searching for Left 4 Dead music on its own, the results usually show short, isolated cues and mixes. In truth, these only scratch the surface of the unique pieces you hear in-game. Those small and simple snippets become cogs in an overwhelmingly complicated machine. For the AI music director, Mike drew inspiration from the world of animation, following his contributions to the visual effects of award-winning film series like Lord of the Rings and The Matrix.
I worked on the Lord of the Rings films, working in the Massive system, which was a quote-unquote AI-driven animation tool, and because I used to be an animator. And it's not really AI. I mean, yes, there are some emergent behaviors of the characters in there. You know, they can see the world and hear the world and whatnot. But really what it comes down to is you're using that sort of emergent behavior and those tools to get the system to make choices for you that are what you would make. You're kind of getting it to make the choices you would make, but then in concert, they make all these other weird choices that you're like, oh, that was cool. But sometimes they make choices that are not cool, right? And the same holds true for sort of this type of system with the music, which is, you know, I kind of generated this mechanism, and it, you know, is basically the music director, I think is literally what it's called in the code, that is trying to make the best choices it can given the data it has.
Creating the final music director was organic. It required Mike to iron out some of the kinks, but it was also able to present its own surprises. But how did it actually work? Although it may seem strange to ask about an AI, what were some of its philosophies on how to select the right stem at a moment's notice?
instead of knowing everything that's happening and sorting through it and making sense of it and then doing the right thing, what it does is it's like everything's kind of poking and going like, I'm doing something, you know. And so whenever a thing goes to play, it might be like, oh, well, something too similar to me has played too recently, so wait a second, right, or whatever. But it's sort of like semi-random, semi-guided way to make choices of what to do. It's sort of a calculated serendipity of sorts, but it's not, there's no way, again, that you could really wrap your whole brain around it, because it's just too much. And there's four players, and then there's the main director that's, you know, spawning characters, and, you know, this, the whole thing is chaos of a sort. It's directed chaos, the whole game is. And so the music really is representative of that. But, you know, it's sort of, again, it's like all the pieces were built so that they could be played in that way. And then the system's built so that it's doing its best job of kind of playing them in a way that does create a tapestry and does create all, you know, this emergent sort of beauty, right? I mean, emergent behavior is sort of the term, the AI term, but, you know, in this context, it's sort of an emergent beauty that comes. And then there's a, you kind of go in and poke at it to keep the stuff that isn't actually interesting or beautiful from happening. And it was a really cool thing to work on and experiment.
If I were to write a version of the sound test as a book, as I am idly considering, Mike's phrase, calculated serendipity, would make an excellent chapter title. That's exactly what the music of Left 4 Dead is. A constructed system that follows strict, set rules, varied and invested enough to produce a dynamic score that really works. Each fully attended co-op session adds three extra layers to the director's workload too, treating each player to their own mix and arrangement. Like the soundtrack for Portal 2 after it, Mike scored Left 4 Dead in a way that lent itself specifically to the gaming experience, balancing order and chaos to form a mechanic as memorable as any other in the title.
Towards the end, especially of Left 4 Dead 1, back then, Valve was small enough that, you know, when we were working on a game, when it came to the last few months, the entire company would work on it, right? And people would set up tests, and there were PCs everywhere, and you know, Xboxes all over the place. And it was also really designed to work and be successful in a multiplayer context. And so, you know, there were just machines everywhere, and everybody's just playing the game everywhere in the building. And as you went around, like, just all this, these weird little cues were just, it was, you know, that tappers, that sound. And it wasn't just the music. Again, the sound kind of all played into it. And it was really neat, like, to hear what a big chaotic mess and yet how serendipitously it worked, you know? It was a unique problem, you know, multiplayer, cooperative sort of game that never repeats itself is an interesting problem, and it was super, super fun to do.
Before moving on to how Mike adapted his music director for Left 4 Dead 2, there's a story that deserves telling. Another Valve mainstay, Ellen McLean, was also on staff for the game, having already voiced GLaDOS, Half-Life 2's Combine Overwatch, and Team Fortress 2's announcer. This time, her role took the form of crying, screeches, and wails for the most chilling special infected, the Witch. I asked Ellen about recording for the Witch, but it turns out that much of that work was completed in a very short time. So much so that Ellen has little memory of it. Funnily enough, she does remember her cut role as Amanda Slater, a survivor who was set to argue with her husband John over the radio. John, who did appear in the final release, was brought to life by John Patrick Lowry, Ellen's real-life husband.
If there is anyone out there, This is John and Amanda Slater. We are a small fishing vessel anchored off Riverside.
Ellen did record some lines as Amanda, improvising an argument with John that never made it. Luckily, when I spoke to Ellen for the previous Portal episode in this series, she offered a close glimpse into Amanda and John's marriage.
Oh, well. Well, John and I bicker all the time. I mean, we've been married for 31 years, and we love each other very much, and we have a fabulous time together. I have to say that it is a great joy for me to be married to another artist, because I think there is great understanding there, particularly when one of us is out of work, because the schedule of an artist is completely erratic. And, you know, lots of times you don't have work, and that's not fun. You know, we always want to have work. And I think that has built a lot of understanding between the two of us. So we have a great time together, but like any married couple, we fight, we bicker, we disagree. And so here we were in the studio. Valve had recently found out that we were married. Because since we have different, you know, last names professionally, they didn't know we were married. So they found out we were married and they thought, oh, what a great joke. Have John and Ellen come in. So it's actually the only time that I've ever worked with Valve where I was in the studio with somebody else recording, and we were asked to improvise. Well, John is a great improviser. John is a great improviser. So I just kind of tried to follow his lead. And so John, of course, and this is John, you know, John always wants to help people. John always wants to extend himself to other people. And me, I'm always, no, we got to be careful. No, we're not going to help anybody. No, there's zombies there. So it's like John took the side of the argument, oh, let's help. Let's be available. Let's be good people. And my side was, no, we're not going to help. No, we're not going to do anything. No. So John led the improvisation and I just went with him.
Amanda Slater may not have made Release, but Ellen's Witch left her mark on players. Through gasps, crying, groaning, and other roles, players can determine the best tactics for beating or avoiding her. Yet another example of sound design's importance to Left 4 Dead. When Left 4 Dead 2 was announced in 2009, fans of the first actually moved to boycott it out of love for the formula. Fortunately, Valve soon proved that support for Left 4 Dead would carry on, and the sequel would be a faithful continuation. In the end, it was, by retaining much of what initially worked and mixing it in with new inventions. The AI director was given an overhaul, and with it, the more focused music director. With the concept of Left 4 Dead's dynamic soundtrack already in place, where did Mike Mraski concentrate his efforts for the second game?
It was just different, I think. The problem was more of a logistical aesthetic problem. I wanted to make sure I didn't rob the players of the learning that they might have gone through about what cues mean what, you know what I mean? And I didn't want to rewrite all the motifs for all the characters. And I didn't really have the time to redo the entire game, you know? I had just done it a year prior. And so it was like, okay, what makes the most sense from an aesthetic standpoint, what makes the most sense from a logistical standpoint, as in what can I do, like what architecture can I come up with that makes sense for what I do replace and what I don't replace, right? I think we came up with a pretty good plan. You know, I mean, it worked out, I think, from both an aesthetic standpoint and like mixing the old with the new, I think it worked out. But that was probably the hardest part, was like, how do I make it sound new and sound Southern, or at least kind of work in the context?
While Left 4 Dead sounds, in large part, like classic horror flicks, the sequel's music follows the narrative into southern states like Georgia and Louisiana. A lot of important blues, folk, and gospel music originated from the southern United States, meaning that Mike had a deeper well to draw from. Since his new compositions had to work with existing cues and be distinctive enough to make their own statements, he settled on a general style that could achieve both functions.
Dark Roots was just getting going as a, you know, American independent music scene thing. I mean, it had existed for a long time, and I had been familiar with it and a fan of it, but it was becoming more popular, right? Like, it was actually kind of like lurking under the mainstream surface. And so I kind of really knew that we wanted that. And there were fans of that type of music at Valve. And so, you know, I think we all kind of saw that as an obvious thing to explore. But then it was sort of like, well, we don't want to redo everything with banjos or whatever, right? Or musical saws. But what's the kind of the right amount of things to redo? And if we start redoing one thing of this type, like, how many other things do we have to redo to stay consistent, you know, with that? And I think that's sort of something anytime you revisit a game or do a sequel to anything, you have to think that through and kind of go, what do I keep from what was there before and what do I make new, that sort of thing. And so that was actually the biggest challenge, I think, in that context, was to do that and also keep in mind, you know, I was super aware of when people invest a lot of time in a game, they become really attached to the elements that are in the game, and they don't like it when they're changed. And B, they're invested in the skills they gain in that game, and you don't want to rob them of that either.
The music heard when a horde of infected are approaching, or indeed right in your face, was among the most frequently heard in Left 4 Dead. In the original, fast-paced drums beat incessant electronic rhythms. Key to getting your blood pumping when mobbed, it would have to make the transition into the sequel smoothly. Fans needed to recognise it, but through Left 4 Dead 2's new southern tone.
There were some challenges, like in, let's say, the mob music, for example. The original idea of mob music with the drums, and then, you know, again, I do this in a lot of these, pretty much every game I've worked on at Valve. There's sort of a reason when I use electronics versus analog instruments or, you know, acoustic instruments. That held true in Left 4 Dead as well. But, you know, when the mobs happened, you know, there's sort of this, the drums, or in the Left 4 Dead was kind of this electronic thing, right? Left 4 Dead 2, it was definitely an experiment to see, like, can I, like, just record a whole bunch of kind of aleatoric improvisation with instruments that are pertinent to the map that we're in, or the, you know, the level that we're playing through, and then chop them up and randomly play them against each other and have that function as like horror music, you know? And I think it succeeded. Because I come from a noise art music background, so, you know, I'm the first to go like, okay, have I done something just too weird? You know, like, if it's just too weird, it's too weird. There were only a couple people who were like, I don't know. And everybody else was like, no, that's cool. Like, what a weird thing to do. In fact, I made a version at one afterwards that took all the different map types of snippets and then jammed them all together programmatically. And God, it just created the coolest weird music that somebody was like, oh, I want that for my phone. And so maybe one of these days I'll write that app.
Horde music in Left 4 Dead 2 marries analog drum improvisation, structured by the music director, with different instruments for each campaign. Some add scratchy fiddles, while others play with banjos or lap steel guitars. All of it feels like the southern United States, culminating in infected, chaotic, and violent hoedowns. The feel Mike aimed for was channeled throughout his music for the sequel, most obviously in the game's jukeboxes. There are several songs the jukeboxes can select, but the fictional band, Midnight Riders, eventually play a part in the story.
So we have this stadium where we're going to have this big showdown, right? I mean, there should be a band, right? And so we kind of went through this thing of like, what do we do with the band? And then, you know, at the time, there was sort of this group of us that were all working together. Jeremy Bennett doing concept art. And, you know, he just quickly, like, we were like, well, it's in the South. And I was like, well, what about, you know, like a Southern, you know, Southern biker band? And it was like, yeah. And I was like, oh, I can totally do that music. Can't create a bunch of characters to add to the game. But, you know, Chet was like, oh, they were there and then they left. And, you know, we can make a guitar, a melee instrument, etc., etc. It's just one of those things, like, when you have a group of super creative people together who don't have to answer to a manager or a director or someone whose vision that your idea might not fit, it really can allow for these types of things to happen, where you get this group of people who are like, oh, here we have a problem. Not only are we going to solve it, but we're going to make it something really cool.
The real-life Midnight Riders consist of Greg Dale's vocals, Jason Roeder on drums, and Mike Moraski in charge of guitars, bass, and keyboards. The community reacted well to their tracks and the mysterious hinted story that runs through the game. Outside of jukeboxes, versions of two of their songs can be heard in The Concert as unique tank themes, and constant references to them through dialogue, graffiti, and posters have piqued people's curiosity. As mentioned in my introduction to this episode, Left 4 Dead 2's jukeboxes contain even more music. The Saints Will Never Come, a short, jazzy rendition of The Saints Go Marching In, which also appears in a scripted event, has a chance of being played, as do two Jonathan Colton songs, RE Your Brains and Portal's Calling Card, Still Alive. Still Alive is rarely played in Left 4 Dead 2, and is thought to be included as a reference to the then unannounced Portal 2. RE Your Brains, however, is much more in tune with the setting, offering a sympathetic take on the zombie lifestyle. When I spoke to Jonathan Colton about his songs for the Portal series, I had some time to bring up RE Your Brains.
Hey, Tom, it's Bob from the office down the hall. It's good to see you, buddy. How have you been? Things have been okay for me, except that I'm a zombie now. I really wish you'd let us in.
Its recording predates Left 4 Dead 2 by a couple of years, so how did it find its way into the release?
I don't remember when they asked me, but at some point they said, hey, could we include this song as an Easter egg in the game? And I said, yeah, sure, that definitely makes sense. But yes, that song came from when I first started doing music full time. I quit this software job that I had had for about 10 years and I started releasing a new song every week for a year as a sort of challenge to myself and a way to pretend it was my job, you know, even though nobody was paying me to do it. And so I was always casting around for ideas that would get me through the process. And this particular week, it was, you know, the image that struck me was this zombie saying, look, all we want to do is eat your brains. It's not, I don't see what the big deal is, which is a, you know, from the perspective of a zombie, it's perfectly reasonable position to take. I mean, this is what we do. We're zombies. What do you expect? You know? So I thought that was a funny idea, and it's something about the corporate nature of that communication struck me as extra funny, that this guy is an office worker, and as a zombie, he's retreating to the kind of communication he was engaged in, you know, the last time he was alive, which is writing a memo to someone. And so he's sort of stuck in that mode. And, you know, it gave me the chance to sort of play with those two voices and sort of smush them together. This, you know, a zombie trying to explain himself and, you know, a coworker trying to convey you know, some emotional content in the language of a memo, which is another, like, you know, multi-shaded thing where it's a hooded secret kind of communication. You know, I mean, if you've worked in an office, you know that you know you can write an email to somebody and you're very angry at them, but you're writing it in this corporate speak and they can tell you're angry, but you're not saying you're angry. And it's sort of like there's an extra code that sits on top of it in that mode of communication, which I think is very, I don't know, very, very funny and strange. So that was the idea, mixing a zombie character with an office character.
Including Jonathan, just for fun, and giving Midnight Riders heaps of extra detail are exactly the creative thoughts that Valve are known for. Whether it's in their music or game mechanics as a whole, they've always done whatever possible to imbue their releases with life and energy. This is exactly why Left 4 Dead and its sequel sound as thrilling as they are innovative. Mike Muraski was consistently given the space and freedom to express and experiment, and his efforts had a profound impact on the final releases. It's hard to imagine the two games without Mike's music, and we never even hear it in the same way twice.
That's sort of the thing that, you know, working at someplace like Valve, where you have that freedom and you're not being dictated by somebody who's a business guy. Nothing against business guys, or even a director who's like, I just make all the decisions, you know, and nothing against directors. Directors are great. I think in some contexts, they're really important, in fact, and we could do to have more of that sometimes. But sometimes, you know, you kind of get this little seed of an idea that sparks, like, interest and excitement and inspiration in the group of people working on it. And then you're allowed to take it to the nth degree and carry through and do it in a way that, you know, that you're proud of and that it adds the most value to the project at hand.
Thanks to Mike, Ellen, and Jonathan for taking the time to speak to me for the sound test. But thank you too for taking the time to listen. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please make sure to subscribe or follow on whatever platform you might be listening on. There will be a new episode next week, though we are nearing the end of this 16-episode series. I'll be posting up details on social media about a second series as I put it together at the start of next year. Check the description for links if you'd like to stay up to date. The next episode is a Commodore 64 special, where I talk to two of the system's most well-known codemasters. Rob Hubbard and Ben Dalglish both give their experiences of composing with Hex for early home consoles, and I can't recommend it enough for fans of retro gaming, or VGM in general. Check back here at 5 p.m. UK time on Fridays for all future uploads.